From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Pope Benedict. What direction is he likely to lead the Catholic Church in, and what direction did he help lead it in as Cardinal Ratzinger? We talk with John Allen, who covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter and is the author of a new book about the new pope. Also, Uncle Mame. We talk with Edwin Wintle about his new memoir. It describes how his life as a single, gay film agent in Manhattan was changed when his troubled niece came to live with him after her mother felt she'd lost control. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist John Allen, has been covering Pope Benedict XVI. In fact, Allen also covered him for years when he was known as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, an independent news weekly. He's also a Vatican analyst for CNN and NPR. In the 90s, he wrote a book about Cardinal Ratzinger. Now Allen has a new book called The Rise of Benedict XVI. Yesterday, in an address to the Diocese of Rome, Pope Benedict condemned gay marriage. He also spoke against trial marriage, free unions, artificial birth control, and abortion. Those positions were no surprise. Cardinal Ratzinger had been Pope John Paul's right-hand man since 1981. For almost a quarter century, he headed the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. In that capacity, Allen says the cardinal was the driving force behind some of the most controversial aspects of John Paul's pontificate, including the crackdown on liberation theology, expanding the borders of infallibility to include the ban on women's ordination, and the disciplining of dissenting theologians. John Allen, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of Pope Benedict's most famous statements back in the days when he was Cardinal Ratzinger had to do with doing battle against, quote, a dictatorship of relativism. What did he mean by relativism? Because I assume this is still going to be a big issue with him as Pope.
Well, Terry, I think it is going to be the defining issue of his pontificate, actually. And I think what he means by that is the following. What the Catholic Church has to do is reassert belief in truth with a capital T. That is, the existence of objective truths that are not relative to person, to time, to culture, but that transcend all of that. Things like the inherent dignity of each and every human life, from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death, the Catholic insistence that salvation for humanity comes exclusively and only through Jesus Christ, and so forth. I think Cardinal Ratzinger and, in the same way, Pope Benedict XVI believe that for four centuries in the West, we have been living in a culture that has sort of been in decline intellectually towards subjectivity, towards the idea that each person can create his or her own truth and so forth, and he intends to do battle against all of that. So this is going to be a papacy that is very actively engaged, for example, in what we call in the States the culture wars, on issues such as stem cell research, gay marriage, abortion. It will also be engaged on other issues where he thinks human dignity is at stake, especially issues of peace and justice around the world. So it's going to be a surprisingly activist pontificate.
We'll get to some of the issues that you just mentioned a little later, but let's start with how his stance on, quote, relativism relates to an issue that's very important in the United States now, an issue of a lot of debate, and that is the separation of church and state.
Well, I think basically, I mean, then Cardinal Ratzinger wrote on this question extensively, and I think his understanding would boil down to this, that there is a legitimate autonomy of the civil sphere, it is wrong for the church to try to impose particular political solutions to given problems that that crop up. But at the same time, this separation cannot become an absolute compartmentalization, that Christian values have something to say to social and cultural debates. And that ultimately, circling back to this question of objectivity, that the truths the church has to defend do mark out certain limits to the power of the state. That is, from his point of view, the state does not have the power to treat a human being as a means to an end. And if it does, it's the responsibility of the church to call the state to task. And you have to remember that some of this passion for truth that he feels, I think, was forged in the crucible of his experience of Nazi Germany. Joseph Ratzinger was 7 when the Nazis came to power, when Hitler came to power for the first time in 1933. He was 18 when the Third Reich fell in 1945. And I think he believes he saw in first person what happens when the state believes that it is no longer shackled by any limits to its power, and when it starts treating lies as truth. So while he would say that it's not the business of the church to decide budgets or to decide tax policy, it certainly is the function of the church to be an active participant in insisting upon these sort of, you know, root principles of truth that ought to have consequences in the culture.
Again, you say that his battle against relativism will be the new pope's defining issue. Let's talk about how that relates to religious pluralism. If Christianity is the only way, in his opinion, where does that leave him in terms of religious pluralism?
Well, I think the Pope is certainly going to want to pursue good neighborly relations with the other religions of the world. I mean, the morning after his installation mass on the April 25th, for example, he had a session with leaders of other religions who had come for the installation mass, made a special point of reaching out to them, particularly to Muslims. And I think he believes that on a wide range of issues, there is fertile territory for Catholics, Christians, and members of other religions to cooperate, especially on moral questions. You'll recall in the mid-90s, for example, the Vatican and a number of Muslim states were great allies in struggles at a couple of UN conferences over abortion and reproductive rights and so forth. Having said all that, this Pope's chief concern, I think, is a robust defense of Catholic identity, making sure it's clear to the world what Roman Catholicism stands for. And part of one of the core claims of Catholic tradition is that salvation comes exclusively through Christ. That is, that Jesus Christ is the lone and unique Savior of the world. And that there isn't a man or woman alive who wouldn't be better off if they didn't know that and accept it and order their lives accordingly. So he is certainly not going to launch new crusades. He is not going to try to impose Catholicism on anyone. But he certainly is going to insist on what in Catholic parlance is called evangelization. That is, inviting people to come to a knowledge of the gospel. His argument would be that clarity about who we are is actually a precondition of dialogue. In other words, you can't really have effective conversation with anyone if you don't know who you are. So in that sense, he's going to try to have his cake and eat it too. That is, it's going to be a very robust defense of the church's traditional doctrine when it comes to other religions, but at the same time, a very genuine desire to have good relations with those religions. And obviously, it remains to be seen the extent to which he's able to pull that off.
How do you think Pope Benedict relates to evangelical Christians? And I'm asking this because both the Pope as a Catholic and evangelical Christians have a missionary mission. That's redundant, doesn't it? A mission of evangelizing, but the bottom line is a little different for Catholics than for evangelical Protestants, and you say that the Pope has been concerned in the past that evangelical Protestants in, for instance, Latin America are trying to convert Catholics into born-again Christians, and that might undermine the mission of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, well, they're not just trying. I mean, they're doing it with great success. If you look around the kind of religious demography of Latin America, you take a place like Guatemala, for example, which, a generation ago was almost entirely Catholic, and today it's just about 60% Catholic, and the attrition, so to speak, has been in favor of these neo-Protestant, aggressively missionary evangelical sects, Pentecostals, Charismatics, and so forth. Peru, you have the same phenomenon. Southern Mexico, you have the same phenomenon. And, of course, it's not just Latin America. I mean, the same thing is happening in Africa. The same thing is happening in the countries of Eastern Europe, the countries of the former Soviet Empire. And that is a subject of obviously grave concern for the Catholic Church, certainly a subject of concern for Benedict. But, the broader question you ask about relations with the evangelicals, on the one hand, I think this Pope has a great admiration for many aspects of evangelical Christianity. He thinks that it's, first of all, it's preserved Christian orthodoxy. They're as clear that salvation is only through Christ as he is, and so there is a terrific simpatico there. They also have a great conviction about the proper role of religion in public life. Just earlier this week, we saw the governor of Texas signing legislation about abortion and gay marriage at an evangelical church, and this is a kind of witness to the kind of social and political activism of Christianity that certainly Pope Benedict would appreciate. On the other hand, there certainly are concerns that Pope Benedict would have. I mean, he would see, I think, many strains of evangelical Christianity as being a bit too individualistic, not having a sufficiently grounded concern for the whole community. He would also see it as being perhaps a bit too seduced by American capitalism. And of course, Pope Benedict has, a kind of ambivalence about capitalism, as many European Catholic intellectuals do. And so there are points of convergence and points of difference there. I think in general, Pope Benedict, however, would believe that the prospects for what's called ecumenism, that is, attempts to heal divisions within Christianity, are probably better for the Catholic Church, all things considered, with the evangelicals than they would be with the mainline Protestant churches of the West, you know, the Episcopalians, the Methodists, the Lutherans, and so forth, that have in recent years kind of moved steadily to the left in terms of many of their teachings on faith and morals and so forth. I mean, you know, the consecration of an openly gay bishop by the Episcopalians in New Hampshire and so on. I think this Pope's top ecumenical priority is going to be with the Eastern Orthodox churches, above all the Russians, but probably in second place will be the evangelicals.
My guest is John Allen. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book is called The Rise of Benedict XVI. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Allen. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book is called The Rise of Benedict XVI. Let's talk a little bit about where the new pope stands on women in the church. One of the things he did was extend infallibility to cover the ban on women's ordination. How did he do that? Why did he do that?
Well, his argument is that after the definition of papal infallibility in 1870 and developments in Catholic theology forward, that what happened is that a lot of people sort of developed this binary understanding of church teaching, which is that either something has been formally declared infallible or it's completely up for grabs. You know, these are the sort of two categories out in the popular mind. And his argument was that, in fact, that's not really the Catholic understanding, that there is a whole range of teachings that have never formally been declared as infallible by a pope, but nevertheless, because they've been taught universally and they've been taught constantly and so forth, you know, are part of the binding teaching authority of the church. And he gave several examples, you know, one of which would be the ban on women's ordination. And so, you know, I mean, to put this very simply, if anybody is expecting that Pope Benedict XVI is going to ordain women, they're living in a fool's paradise. I mean, this is not going to happen under this pontificate. But I think there may be surprising room for conversation about women's role in the church apart from the ordination question. I mean, let's not forget that in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, for many years, one of the Pope's collaborators was a Belgian female theologian by the name of Marie Hendricks. He has a very close collaborator, German woman by the name of Ingrid Stampe. I think there is, and the man he just appointed to be his successor at the Congregation for the Faith, Archbishop William LeVade of San Francisco, appointed the first female chancellor of a diocese in the United States.
Like President Bush, Pope Benedict opposes stem cell research, as do many political conservatives now in the United States. But Pope Benedict also opposes in vitro fertilization. There hasn't been a lot of political opposition in the United States against in vitro fertilization. What are his reasons for opposing in vitro fertilization and stem cell research?
I guess stem cell we'd
know from the arguments here. But what about in vitro fertilization?
Well, I suppose it's both a kind of philosophical objection and then a practical one. I mean, at the practical level, the techniques of in vitro fertilization that exist at the moment tend to involve one of two things that the Catholic Church would consider morally objectionable. I mean, first is that in virtually every case we know of, embryos are created which are subsequently destroyed. That is, you don't just create one embryo, implant it, and bring it to term. Usually a surplus of embryos is created with the intention that not all of them will eventually be born. And that, in the Church's analysis, is treating a human life as a means to an end. And that an embryo deserves the same, has the same dignity, and therefore deserves the same protection of the law as any other human being. The other is that even in cases where you've got a married heterosexual couple that is attempting to reproduce, if they go to a clinic to try to get help with in vitro fertilization, the husband has to somehow donate his genetic materials, and quite often that involves masturbation, which is also considered morally illegitimate by the church. But I suppose the deeper philosophical question here is that the church insists that that each human being has the right to be born in and through natural marriage. This is the, in some ways, the same logic that the church opposes birth control, that it separates what is considered to be the sexual act from the procreative act, and sexual acts ought to be open to the transmission of life. That's the traditional teaching of the church. And so both of these positions, that is the condemnation of embryonic stem cell research, because of course there is also adult stem cell research, which the church would support and endorse. But embryonic stem cell research and in vitro fertilization both flow from that. And you're quite right that the position of the Republican Party in the United States, or for that matter, the conservative parties in Europe, might be closer to the church on many of these questions, but it certainly is not, there's not a uniformity between the two things, which is why when the church gets involved on these political questions, usually what they will say, church leaders will say, is that on these issues, the position of the conservative parties is perhaps preferable, but it certainly is not the totality of what the church believes.
Well, the church's position is going to be basically put to a vote soon in Italy. You're right that Italy had no law governing reproductive technology until February of last year. And then it adopted a very strongly restrictive statute. But there's going to be a referendum on that statute coming up pretty soon, right?
Next week, yeah.
Oh, okay then.
Yeah. I mean, Italy used to be the Wild West of assisted reproduction. I mean, when I moved to Italy 5 years ago, there was a story about a 65-year-old woman who had gone to a fertility clinic and gotten help with being impregnated and so forth and carried a child to term. I mean, it was really an anything-goes environment. And then last year, Italy's conservative government under Prime Minister Berlusconi adopted a very restrictive statute, the heart of which is that it bars in vitro and assisted reproductive techniques to anything other than married heterosexual couples. So gay couples, single mothers, and so forth don't have access to these services. It insists that only three embryos may be created, and they all have to be implanted. That is, there's no cryogenic preservation. And it declares embryos as holders of human rights. And what has happened is that forces in Italy opposed to those restrictions have organized a referendum seeking to overturn each of those provisions. Now, this is a classic case in which the church would say that even that restrictive law wasn't enough because it still allows for the artificial creation of embryos, which it is opposed to. But it's certainly better than the proposed alternatives. So rather than urging a yes or no vote, what the church in Italy has done is urge voters to abstain, that is, simply not show up at all. Because under Italian law, if fewer than 50% of Italians fail to vote, then the referendum automatically dies. And I would add that this is not just good moral analysis on the church's part from its own principles, but it also is very crafty politics, because trying to get a no vote on this referendum could be difficult, because typically in Italy, only the people who are really motivated to support the referendum show up. But by persuading people just not to go at all, they stand a much better chance of success. Most polling right now says it's very much a jump ball which way this is going to go. Pope Benedict, by the way, has very clearly and publicly endorsed the activism of the Italian bishops trying to promote abstention on this referendum.
Now, when it comes to like reproductive issues, the Pope has opposed condoms even as a way to prevent HIV. How has that been playing around the world, particularly in places like Africa, where the AIDS epidemic is so extreme?
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing to say here, and you know, you're asking a fully legitimate question, which I'll come to in a moment, but we shouldn't think that, particularly on the HIV/AIDS issue, that the only thing the church has to say is its position on condoms. I mean, 27% of HIV/AIDS sufferers around the world actually are under the care of Catholic facilities. It is by far the largest humanitarian organization of its kind engaged in providing relief to victims of this epidemic. And I think at that level, there is kind of universal admiration for Catholic religious orders, diocesan facilities, individual operations supported by the church in some way, that are engaged in running hospices, running clinics, trying to get drugs to people, and so on. Obviously, the church's position on condoms has been a subject of great controversy and great debate both inside and outside the church. One thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that the specific question of whether or not condoms can be legitimately used in the context of heterosexual marriage to try to prevent the transmission of disease, that specific question, the Pope, either John Paul II or Pope Benedict, has never directly spoken on that question. And this is why, even at the very senior levels of the Catholic Church, you get debate on this. I mean, there are cardinals who have suggested that the church ought to accept the use of condoms in this context as a means of fighting disease on the grounds that, the church disapproves of extramarital sex. But if someone is determined to engage in that kind of conduct in any event, surely it would be better if they also at least try to do so in a way that that preserves the health of the other person involved. That's a position that other senior officials in the church would disagree with. But my point is, this is, to some extent, theologically an open question. And it certainly will be a question that a lot of people are waiting to see if Benedict XVI is going to try to settle.
John Allen is the author of the new book, The Rise of Benedict XVI. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty.
Coming up, more about Pope Benedict with John Allen. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. Also, a single gay film agent takes in his troubled 13-year-old niece after her mother felt she'd lost control. We talk with Edwin Wintle about his new memoir, Breakfast with Tiffany.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Allen. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter, an independent news weekly. He's also a Vatican analyst for CNN. He's written a new book called The Rise of Benedict XVI. As a journalist who covers the Vatican, what was your reaction when Tom Rees, the long-term editor of the Jesuit publication America, was forced out of his position because the church objected to some of the articles and commentaries that it ran? Because some of the articles and commentaries questioned some of the church's positions.
Yeah, well, my first reaction was sadness because Tom is a friend and a colleague, and I also just know where he was sort of emotionally and professionally because we both had just lived through covering the conclave, the death of John Paul, the election of Benedict XVI, and everything that followed. It was an enormously, both professionally and emotionally, intense month, it was just a terrible way for him to have to come out of all of that. I would add that over the years I've been a great admirer of America Magazine and Tom Rees. I think they do a first-class job in trying to promote a forum for discussion in the Catholic Church and in trying very faithfully to represent all points of view in that discussion. On the other hand, that's my personal reaction. As a journalist, I would say I also recognize that this discussion is complicated by the fact that America Magazine is an official publication of the Jesuit order, and therefore it is, in a sense, an official publication of the Catholic Church. And from the Vatican's point of view and the point of view of a number of bishops, therefore different standards ought to apply. That is, that they would argue that the fundamental obligation of an official Catholic publication is to make sure that the teaching of the Church is faithfully and clearly articulated. Now, that's not to say that you can't acknowledge that there's discussion about some of these points. That's not to say you can't publish other points of view, but that in the balance, what ought to predominate is the clarity of the exposition of what the Church stands for. The other thing I would say is that I wouldn't exaggerate how catastrophic all this is going to be. I mean, the new editor there, Drew Christensen, is a man certainly an admirer and supporter of Tom Rees, he will want to maintain America's reputation as a place where all points of view can be heard. No doubt on some particular questions like abortion and condoms and stem cell research, some of the things we've been talking about, there will be a slightly greater degree of caution. But I don't think it's going to be the case that America Magazine is going to be destroyed by any of this.
Pope Benedict, back when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, was the head of Pope John Paul's doctrinal office. And what can we learn about Pope Benedict to see who he's chosen for that position?
Oh, I think it's actually fascinating. I mean, Pope Benedict has named as his successor Archbishop William Levade of San Francisco. This is the only really significant personnel move he's made to date. And I think it is very telling because I think some of the expectations about Pope Benedict, I think both on the Catholic right and the Catholic left in some ways, is that because he had been for 24 years the top cop of the Catholic Church, that is the great enforcer, the great bruiser in Catholic affairs, that once he took over the top job, there would be this kind of night of the long knives that would follow, and there would be a great purge of dissent and so forth. And to date, and we're now almost 50 days into the pontificate, none of that has materialized. And I think in the Levade appointment, what you have is a man who clearly is a doctrinal conservative, as you would expect for anyone who would move into that job. But by no means does he have a reputation as a headhunter. Quite the opposite. He is seen as somebody who is very clear in his principles, but is very flexible in the application of those principles, who is always seeking to diffuse conflict rather than to allow it to fester. And interestingly, when his appointment was rumored and then announced, the most ferocious early criticism of it actually came from the Catholic right in the United States that felt Levade should have been tougher against the gay culture in San Francisco. And they pointed especially to something that happened in 1997 when Archbishop Levade was faced with a new law in San Francisco that threatened to cut off any city funds to organizations that did not provide health benefits for same-sex domestic partners. And Archbishop Levade insisted that that would force the church to compromise its teaching on homosexuality. It looked like the church might actually lose about $6 million in public funding that went largely to care for HIV/AIDS patients and other charitable activities. At the end, what Archbishop Lovaeda proposed was a solution that sort of shifted the focus from homosexuality to healthcare. And he said, well, how about this? We'll adopt a policy where our employees can designate any legally domiciled member of their household they want, whether it's a same-sex partner or it's their mother or it's their aunt or whoever. And that way, we're expanding health care. We're not specifically endorsing same-sex relationships. The city bought the compromise. The conflict was avoided. So, bottom line, I think by putting Archbishop Lovaeda in this job, Pope Benedict has opted for someone who clearly will safeguard the teaching of the church, but is not going to be looking to create conflict if he can avoid it, who is actually a very adept administrator and a very creative administrator. Therefore, this does not augur the great crackdown or great purge that I think some people have been expecting.
John, how do you think covering Pope Benedict is going to compare to covering Pope John Paul?
I think it's going to be a better gig for the pencil press than the TV, put it that way. I mean, I think it's going to be a less theatrical, less dramatic, less showy papacy. There will be fewer trips, fewer grand gestures, but it's going to be an enormously thoughtful papacy. I mean, this is probably the best prepared intellectual to be elected pope since Leo XIII in the 19th century. I mean, this is a man who has published more than 50 books. He has thought deeply over the course of a lifetime about the intellectual trends, particularly in the developed West, and the need for the church to confront them. In that sense, I would say that anyone who believes that a 78-year-old German was elected largely as a transitional pope has got another think coming. Because to be honest with you, there is not a transitional bone in Joseph Ratzinger's body. This is a pope who intends to do business. I think it's going to be a papacy very much worth watching.
So what's the biggest change you think he's going to make?
Well, I think he is going to want to try to shake up the internal culture of the church. I think one of the things about John Paul II that everyone would agree on is that his real passion and his charisma was directed at the world outside the church. I mean, he actually did very little tinkering with the kind of internal levers of power in the Catholic Church for 26 years. You know, his was very much a roadshow, and he wanted to evangelize the broader culture, reach out to other Christians and other religions and so on. I think Pope Benedict is going to be a little bit more focused in terms of those kinds of internal dynamics. I think his concern is that the church tends to mimic the secular world in creating institutions and creating structures and breeding career paths and so forth. And at the end, some of those structures and some of those career paths end up forgetting why they exist. They become self-perpetuating and, you know, self-justifying. And he wants to challenge all of that. So I think we're going to see a smaller ecclesiastical bureaucracy. And I think in senior positions, you are going to see him appointing more experts and more people of substance and fewer people who have simply, you know, risen the career ladder, so to speak. And so there's going to be a bit of a culture change inside the Catholic Church, maybe a bit slow in coming, but it's going to be real. I think that, too, is going to be fascinating to see develop.
Well, John Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's always a pleasure.
John Allen is the author of the new book, The Rise of Benedict XVI. He covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. Coming up, a single gay man in Manhattan takes in his troubled 13-year-old niece, and both their lives are changed. This is Fresh Air. Edwin Wintle was a single, 40-year-old gay man working in Manhattan, negotiating book-to-film deals, when overnight he became a parent to his 13-year-old troubled niece from Connecticut. It was her mother, Wintle's sister, who asked for this change. Wintle has written a memoir about how the first year of this new arrangement changed his niece's life and his own. He calls her Tiffany in the book and titled his memoir Breakfast with Tiffany. Ed, why did your sister ask you to take her 13-year-old daughter?
In a nutshell, my sister felt that she was losing control of my niece, that she couldn't keep her safe any longer.
Safe from what?
I guess from her own inclination, she started running with a crowd that my sister felt was really dangerous, insofar as just, you know, getting in cars with older boys and staying out past when she was supposed to be out, experimenting with things she wasn't supposed to. I think my sister felt that she could no longer impose restrictions on my niece that my niece would honor, and therefore she couldn't keep control of her and keep her safe from harm.
What was the proportion of anxiety, fear, and enthusiasm when your sister asked you to take your niece in to live with you? Was there a part of you that really wanted to do this, or was this more of like a duty that you felt obliged to fulfill?
Definitely a part of me really wanted to do it. I had offered, sort of in an emergency situation, I said, you know, if it ever comes to it, she's welcome to come live with me. That was, of course, a little bit off the cuff, but I think it came from a place of really desiring that. I've just had an incredible relationship with my niece her whole life. She had stayed with me for a couple of summers, I think 6 weeks one summer and then 3 or 4 weeks the next summer, a couple years earlier, to study acting and theater arts here in the city. And I just am nuts about the kid. And I think there was a part of me that really wanted to pitch in, really wanted to help make a difference in her life. And then the anxiety and the self-doubt and the nervousness took over when I realized the enormity of what I had just said I would do.
What were the first things you felt you had to change about your life and about your home when you knew your niece was going to come to live with you?
Well, I knew I had to get rid of my porn collection, which is, you know, a joke, but not a joke. And I had a roommate.
How big is it? That was such a concern.
It wasn't very big. It was sort of a small duffel bag. And then, of course, I saved the best of it and gave it to a friend to hold on to, but the rest I threw away. And my diaries. I had diaries that I'd been keeping since high school, and I didn't want those just to be lying around. You know, you got to have some boundaries. I had a part-time roommate, so I had to quickly ask him to find another arrangement. But mostly it was just kind of getting the environment ready for her, you know, clearing out, getting it prepared for her to come, which was going to be in all of 1 week's time. So it was very, very quick turnaround from the time my sister asked me to take her in till the time she arrived.
Did you know how to be an authority figure? Had you ever been in the position before where you were really responsible for a young life and you had to be the one that created the limits and drew the line?
No, I have never been a teacher. I did work with kids in college, and I, of course, babysat as a teenager. But I think I have a predisposition to being somewhat of a strict parent. I think my own parenting predilection would be toward being a tough parent. I think that I would be able to impose discipline and not worry that the child was angry with me, you know, trusting that our love would ultimately carry us through. So I hadn't had a lot of experience, but I kind of had the idea that I would be tough but loving, I guess tough love.
That's interesting that you thought you would do the tough love thing, because one of the things that you were worried about with your niece was that she had close friends who smoked a lot of marijuana, so you were concerned about that. You knew that she had friends who were having sex, very concerned about that. On the other hand, you write that when you were in high school, before you graduated, you tried nearly every drug under the sun. You had never really held yourself back from sexual adventures. So you had done some of the things that you were now determined to make sure she didn't do when she was young. So what are some of the things that you told your niece about your own life that you thought would be serve as kind of like cautionary tales for her?
Well, I told her, I would say in general terms, I told her that I felt that in high school when I began to smoke more pot, that I began to lose some of my motivation. I told her that I felt that I wished I had spent more time pursuing creative things, creative endeavors, rather than just hanging around, kind of killing time with my friends. That was kind of it. I mean, and I would include pot in that and include some of the, you know, I don't think I went into too many experiences about drugs because there weren't really that many in high school. But and as far as sex goes, I talked to her about boys because I felt like I was qualified. I had one conversation with her where, you know, I said whenever I would start talking about boys, she would say, "Oh no, not the boy, the boy talk again." And I would say, "You know, Tiffany, I've grew up with two older sisters. I have a zillion female friends who have been through every kind of relationship under the sun with men, and I myself am gay, and I dated hundreds of guys, and I had kind of been through all of that, and I was hoping that I could share my experience with her about that. You know, I know a lot about how guys operated because I'm also a guy myself, and so I would try to share that with her."
How did you handle your own private life when you became a full-time guardian of your niece? You know, did you feel as comfortable, you know, bringing men home or going out at night?
Oh, it completely changed. You know, I wasn't much of a party guy or a man about town, really, as far as, you know, I was 40 when she moved in. I had kind of left a lot of the bar hopping and stuff behind quite a while before that. But I had quite an active social life and, you know, and I would date, and when my niece moved in with me, that completely changed. Dating was the farthest thing from my mind. I had no time and no energy to give to somebody else. So it actually didn't feel like a sacrifice because I didn't feel like doing it. But my life changed. Social life, schedule, everything changed so drastically when she moved in. But I was happy to do it. It gave me a renewed sense of purpose. It gave me a great feeling to try to do something for someone else. I mean, let's face it, I was 40, single, gay, not a whole lot of responsibilities to other people. And living in Manhattan, where we kind of get involved in our careers and involved in our social lives, and it's pursuing little hobbies maybe, it's not about other people that often. And I hadn't been doing any volunteer work for quite some time. I used to work with the elderly. And suddenly I was able to do something for somebody, and it just felt great.
My guest is Edwin Wintle. His new memoir is called Breakfast with Tiffany. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Edwin Wintle. His new memoir, Breakfast with Tiffany, is about what happened when his troubled 13-year-old niece Tiffany came to live with him in Manhattan. Her mother, Wintle's sister, suggested this arrangement because she'd lost control of her daughter.
Is Tiffany still living with you?
No, she's not.
She's back with her mother?
Yes.
How did you, Tiffany's mother, and Tiffany decide that it was time to go back and live with her mother?
Well, what happened was, I think Tiffany, we went through the first year, and the book ends at the end of the first year. She'd made the honor roll. She had won an award as the best freshman writer in her class. She'd really made a big turnaround. And in the second year, things were going very, very well, very, very smoothly. And then after she turned 15, in a nutshell, I would say she kind of began rebelling against me the way she had against her mom. She began to feel that I was not it wasn't my place to make decisions for her. And when you have a 15-year-old under your care and they feel that you can't basically tell them what to do or be the final word on things, it becomes a very untenable situation. Because I wasn't going to put myself in a situation of not being able to keep her safe because she was going to be making decisions that I thought were bad for her well-being. So somewhere in the middle of that second year, I had to begin warning her that if she kept battling me on the limits that I was setting and on the decisions I was making, that ultimately the situation might not work out. And so at the end of March of the second year, I had to follow through on that warning and insist that she leave.
What's one of the most disturbing things that happened after the book ends, before your family agreed that it was time for her to go back to Connecticut, that you couldn't, you no longer felt that you could protect her adequately?
Mm-hmm. I would say it would be that she had met these two girls, one of whom, two girls who were completely unsupervised, and my niece began sort of wanting to be parented the way these girls were being parented, which was basically non-existent, and it was causing a great deal of tension in our relationship, the kinds of freedom she was asking for, and it led to several very intense verbal arguments on our part. And she did actually walk out of the apartment one evening on a rainy January night and with a bag in tow. And I had to go to the police station and we had to go do a drive around and look for her and, you know, put out a whatever they put out to other police officers to keep an eye out for her. That was a very, very disturbing night. The police did find my niece on the train heading upstate again, and they intercepted her and delivered her into the hands of my parents. And that was a very, very rough night. And I think it was disturbing to me that things could, you know, escalate to that degree after all the progress we had made while she was living with me.
This is the kind of thing she had pulled when she was living with her mother, that she would disappear.
Right. And this is now the second year of her living with me, and it was a result of having met these two in her high school in New York City, Lower East Side public high school. She didn't make very many close girlfriends. It was kind of cliquey, at least to hear her describe it, and more the boys were, you know, befriending her. And it wasn't until Halloween night of her second year that she met two girls who were very much like the friend she had in Connecticut. And she met them outside of the school situation through a friend who lived downstairs in our building. And once she met those two girls, it's almost like she completely regressed into wanting to do what she had been doing in Connecticut again. You know, she kind of got a taste of that again and wanted to be running around and staying out late and, you know, going to clubs and all of that. And ultimately, that led to these arguments that we would have, which led her to walk out, you know, against my will with a bag in hand at, you know, 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. So that was a very, very disturbing dark night, as you could imagine, because I felt like so much of the progress we made had been suddenly erased.
Do you have any second thoughts about sending her back to Connecticut? Do you think maybe it would have been better for her to stay in New York even if you were losing control, even if she was defying you?
No, the one of the two girls that I mentioned became completely addicted to heroin. The other girl ended up dropping out of school, and not that my niece would have done these things because these girls had, but I felt that there was really bad news ahead here in the city. But also, more importantly, Terry, is that the choice would have been for me to let her stay and just let her do what she wants, and I was not comfortable with that. I could not be an adult living with a child of 15 who was able to do what they wanted. I couldn't live with that situation. I was not willing to accept the responsibility for what could happen to her if I were to let her do what she wanted. And there was becoming no way to not let her do what she wanted, because she would do what she wanted, if you follow what I'm saying. So I realized that was beyond the responsibility I was willing to accept.
Are you still close? What's your relationship like now?
We're very, very close. It's sort of nice because now we're, I can be the cool uncle again because I'm not the authority figure. So there was definitely a little chilling period there after she first left. We actually got her into another program, a live-in program for a while, but it didn't work out. And then she went back to live with her mom. So it wasn't like I just sent her back to her mom. Really what I felt was that she needed more help at that point than I could give. In other words, my discipline wasn't able to break through her willfulness. And so we got her into another program. And then ultimately she chose to not stay there and move back in with my sister. Now we're very close again. And she calls me with, you know, boy problems. And we talk about stuff more like we used to. And I think she's turned a corner, too, just by virtue partially of getting a little older. She's now 16, and I think she's left some of that behavior behind. And she also has seen the effect it's had both on her life in that she was forced to leave the city and, you know, not able to live with me anymore, but also some of her friends. She's seen them drop out of high school. She's seen different things happen. And I think it suddenly has become a bit more real, the consequences of behavior. It's like when you're 12, 13, 14, it still doesn't feel real. But when you're 15, 16, 17, I think it starts to become a reality. You start to realize, okay, my college choices are going to be limited because I haven't been getting good grades, that sort of thing. So I see her now as being a bit more mellow and towing the line a bit better now than she had been for a little while there.
Well, Ed Wintle, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ed Wintle's new book is called Breakfast with Tiffany, an Uncle's Memoir. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Next Fresh Air, Vladimir Putin's Russia. It's not a communist state, but it's not exactly a democracy. We'll talk with Peter Baker and Susan Glasser of The Washington Post. They were the Post's Moscow bureau chiefs from 2001 to 2004. They've written a new book called Kremlin Rising. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.